Have you ever been really scared, or have you ever been a little bit scared? So maybe you've gone for a walk and you've stumbled, and only just to catch yourself at the last minute. There was a little bit of a scare, and then there was a little bit of a relief. Or maybe you faced a bad diagnosis from the doctor, or maybe it was a child or a loved one, only to be met with a cure, or perhaps a change of opinion. And so when there's a slight scare, there's a slight relief. But when there's a huge scare, there is a huge relief. And we'll see a people that faced a huge scare in the book of Esther, the Jewish people. And we'll see that there's a huge relief at the end of it. But if you're a Christian and you can remember at some point in your life, a time when you knew you were not a friend of God, you were his enemy. Or looking back, how you've seen that you stood at the mouth of hell. And just appreciate now his grace and his goodness of the good news of his message. You can empathize with these people as you see the great joy of no longer being an enemy, facing judgment, but having salvation. And really, that's the main point I want to get across this morning, that the joy of salvation. And so we see a very frightened people facing disastrous circumstances. Now, if you remember previously, you might be saying, why is this? Well, we'll see as we go through this passage, we'll see how judgment and salvation work together. They promised later on that we see them in chapter 9 working together. And the end of 9, we'll see how they must be remembered. But where's our story so far? Surely, at end of last week, the credits were rolling on this film. It's a happy ending. Esther has helped the king see how he's been manipulated. Haman, the enemy of the Jewish people, has been executed. Surely that's the end. But there's a problem. Instead of credits rolling, we see that there's a law that's gone out throughout the empire, throughout the known world, that has called for the destruction of the Jewish people. And so rather than our movie ending, there's dun, 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 tune in for next week. And so here we are, having a look at the next chapter. What can be done? This law cannot be changed, and it's gone throughout the empire. What's going to happen? So have a look at Esther, chapter 8, looking at verse 3. Esther again pleaded with the king, falling at his feet, weeping. She begged him to put an end to the evil plan of Haman, the Agagite, which he had devised against the Jews. Then the king extended the gold scepter to Esther, and she arose and stood before him. If it pleases the king, she said, and if he regards me with favor and thinks it's the right thing to do, and if he is pleased with me, let an order be written overruling the dispatch that Haman, son of Hammath, the Agagite, devised, and wrote to destroy the Jews in all the king's provinces. For how can I bear to see disaster fall on my people? How can I bear to see the destruction of my family? King Xerxes replied to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, because Haman attacked the Jews, I have given his estate to Esther, and they have impaled him on the pole he set up. Now write another decree in the king's name on behalf of the Jews as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For no document written in the king's name sealed with his ring can be revoked. At once the royal secretaries were summoned on the 23rd day of the third month, in the month of Sivan. They wrote out all Mordecai's orders to the Jews and to the satraps, governors, and nobles of the 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. These orders were written in the script of each province and the language of each people, and also to the Jews in their own script and language. Mordecai wrote in the name of King Xerxes, sealed the dispatches with the king's signet ring, and sent them by mounted couriers who rode fast horses, especially bred for the king. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city in the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate the armed men of any nationality or province who might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the province of King Xerxes was the 13th day of the 12th month in the month of Adar. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers riding the royal horses went out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. When Mordecai left the king's presence, he was wearing royal garments of blue and white, and a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen. And the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. In every province and every city to which the edict of the king came, there was joy and gladness among the Jews, with feasting and celebrating. And many people of other nationalities became Jews because the fear of the Jews had seized them. We'll carry on with that reading in a moment. Queen Esther again approaches King Xerxes, and it is something you do under threat of death, even the queen, but he extends his golden scepter to her. So she summons up the courage and approaches him again. She asks for the law to be changed, but the law cannot be changed, but another decree of not judgment, but of salvation to the Jewish people can be written. The right to defend themselves, to anticipate who their enemies are. And it's sent throughout 127 provinces, almost the known world, the empire. The law is sent out fast. And so we have the law of judgment accompanied by a law of rescue. Now imagine if you were in one of those far-reaching cities of the empire, a Jew, and this law had come about, your destruction was at hand. It was marked off in the calendar. You could count down the days. And it was coming. So I'm going to have my first point. Under the threat of death, God's champion is bringing salvation. So that's our first point. As these Jews are under the threat of death, facing destruction, there is a champion in the court of the king bringing salvation. And so you, a Jew in that empire, knowing that the day of your destruction is written down, people walk by in the streets, a neighbor sniggers and goes like this, "The day is coming. I can't wait to see you on the 13th day of the 12th month, my friend. Your house is mine. It's nicer than my house. You're going to die. And there's nothing you can do about it." Under the death sentence. But then there's a thundering of hooves as the king's horse comes in, bringing the law that there is a right to defend yourself. Salvation is at hand. The fastest transport known to mankind in the empire at that time, it goes throughout and it gives you permission with the rest of God's people to stand together and defend yourselves. And so there's joy. The death sentence, though it was hanging over you, there now is a chance of salvation. And it's greater than a chance because the king's right-hand man, Mordecai, is enthroned at his right hand, and therefore the king's favor is with you. And so it's a great reversal. There were the forces of evil, the Persian, throughout the Persian Empire, waiting to destroy these Jewish people. You, but now God's champion has been installed. And it's a picture of revolution. And really it's a picture looking forward to the revolution that took place on the cross. God's enemy, the devil, enemy of God's people, who had wrought about death and destruction, pain, had brought it into the world that you now live under. Well, his day was coming to an end. And on the cross, as Jesus Christ took the punishment, he brought about salvation and good news as he made a public spectacle of God's enemies, the devil, and all those the spiritual forces on the cross. And so we're like the people, we've heard the good news of salvation It's at hand, yet we're still living under the threat of death in this world, the power of sin. And so for you this morning, it will mean that if you're a Christian, you know that the victory is at hand. You know how it ends, yet you're living in a world of brokenness, of pain and sickness, of heartache and evil and corruption and injustice. But you know your champion is there rooting for you, and he will come to avenge all those against the forces of evil one day. And so that chapter in Revelation, as difficult as it is, it's a chapter of Jesus coming again, victorious, to get rid of God's enemies. Under the threat of death, God's champion is bringing salvation. Well, let's look at our second point. Judgment and salvation work together. And so if we can have our next slide, judgment and salvation work together. And let's have a look at chapter 9. I'm going to do the reading from chapter 9, 1 to 19. On the 13th day of the 12th month, in the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews, on the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities in all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those determined to destroy them. No one could stand against them because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the province, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews because a fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. The Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them. And they did what they pleased to those who had hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They also killed, and there's a list of the sons of Haman, verse 10, the 10 sons of Haman, Hamadatha, the enemy of the Jews. But they did not lay hands on the plunder. The number of those killed in the citadel of Susa were reported to the king that same day. The king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? It will also be granted." "If it pleases the king," Esther answered, "give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out on this day the edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be impaled on poles." So the king commanded this to be done, and the edict was issued in Susa, and they impaled the 10 sons of Haman. The Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Susa 300 men, but they did not lay hands on their plunder. Meanwhile, the remainder of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also assembled to protect themselves and get relief from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of them, but did not lay hands on their plunder. This happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. The Jews in Susa, however, had assembled on the 13th and the 14th, and then on the 15th day they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. That is why rural Jews, those living in villages, observe the 14th of the month of Adar as a day of joy and fasting and a day of giving presents to each other. Well, what do we make of this reading? It's the kind of reading you'd be embarrassed for those that you know that are not churchgoers to hear. It seems like a very unchristian passage. I mean, there's sweet Esther who was pleading for her life now saying, "Can we have another day of killing, please, King?" It seems absolutely bloodthirsty. But think about it. The decree that had gone out that the Jewish people may defend themselves was in the third month. It's now the 12th month. There's been 9 months in which people can decide which side they want to be on. And we even see some people converting to Judaism. I mean, the sons of Haman, if they could have converted. But they were blinded by their hate. See, those that attacked them, There's no innocent casualties here. There was fight or to be destroyed, kill or be killed. And what's even more shocking is that in the capital, where it is quite well known that Mordecai is the right-hand man of the king, where they've had plenty of time to realize this, in the seat of power, 500 people are killed in Susa because they want to kill the Jewish people. And then 350 the next day. That's 850 people are killed in the capital city, in the seat of the empire, in the seat of government. Imagine if we heard the news that 850 armed people had, terrorists had tried to destroy those in parliament. And they were stopped. We would be relieved. We would think this is a good thing, as shocking as it is. And so in the seat of government, there are people that have known for 9 months what the verdict is. They've known where the king's leaning is, but they have hated God's people so much, and they have now been met with justice. It spreads out throughout the empire. And while we know that, you know, as I'm sure there's people involved, and so some of these attacks might have been done with glee, the one thing that is clear, that's mentioned three times, they did not take hold of the plunder. They did not steal people's possessions. When this law originally went out to destroy the Jews, Haman said, okay, you can kill them and you can take their possessions. And so there was a financial incentive for people to destroy the Jewish people. The law then goes out and says that the Jews are allowed to defend themselves and take plunder. And we're told they do not. See, it's reminiscent of in Joshua, whereas they were destroying God's enemy in the land. They did not get financial compensation for it. They went out and God said, burn, destroy, don't take anything, because they're administrating God's judgment. And so it's a picture of justice and judgment. It's really a small picture of what happens on the last day when Jesus comes again, when justice will be done. And as we read that passage that was quite terrifying in Revelation of Jesus coming in all his glory, imagine for a moment if you are living in a country like North Korea, a country like Ethiopia, where your brothers and sisters who are Christians have been put in shipping containers in the desert just because they believe in Christ, where people in countries like North Korea are killed up to the third generation because their grandfather believed in Jesus. When you have that passage of the Jesus that is mocked coming in glory in Revelation 19, it's a scene of comfort. It's terrifying, but you know justice will be done. And so imagine the Jews, as they had heard that edict, that salvation was coming, but judgment was coming too. Imagine if you had been sitting there thinking to plot, oh, I'd like to take that Jewish neighbor's house. I'll get him. And suddenly this comes out. You might have a change of heart to think, oh, well, I'm going to put myself under the king's protection. You see, there's no third option here. You either choose to side with God's people and God's champion, or you choose to go against him. And so the message for us today is the same. There's no neutral ground. Either Christ is your champion and your king, or you are his enemy. And the day of justice and judgment and salvation is coming. They go together. And so I would say to you that if you're confused about that, if you're unsure, don't put it off any longer. There's someone you can speak to. There's books at the back of church. Choose the right side now before destruction comes, so that Jesus will come as your champion and not your judge. Well, let's turn to our third point. And so this is chapter 9, verse 20 to 10. And this final point, if we can have the next slide, is judgment and salvation must be remembered and celebrated. So let's have a look at chapter 9, verse 20. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the province of the king of King Xerxes, near and far, that they should celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar. At this time, when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month, as as the month when their sorrow had turned to joy and their mourning into a day of celebration, he wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy, giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews agreed to continue the celebration they had begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman's sons, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them, and he had cast the pur, that is the lot, for their ruin and destruction. But when the plot came to the king's attention, he issued written orders that the evil scheme Haman had devised against the Jews should come back on his own head, and he and his sons should be impaled on poles. Therefore, these days were called Purim, from the word pur, because of everything written in this letter, and because of what they had seen and what had happened to them. The Jews took it on themselves to establish the custom that they and their descendants and all who joined them should without fail observe these 2 days every year in the way prescribed at the time appointed. These days should be remembered and observed in every nation by every family and every province and every city. And the days of Purim should never fail to be celebrated by the Jews, nor should the memory of these days die out among their descendants. So Queen Esther, daughter of Abiel, along with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm the second letter concerning Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews in the 127th province of the Xerxes kingdom, words of goodwill and assurance, to establish these days of Purim at their designated times, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had decreed for them, as they established for themselves and their descendants in regard to their times of fasting and lamentation. Esther's decree confirmed these regulations about Purim and was written down in the records. So this last part seems a little bit dry. It seems a lot of administration. But can you see the emphasis on remembrance? The festival called Purim, which is remembered after the dice that Haman used, it really points to God working behind, orchestrating events for salvation. And do you notice how they celebrate it? They get gifts, they celebrate, they give food to the poor and food to one another. See, it's not a day of vengeance like bonfire night when we burn the effigy, the guy, on the bonfire, remembering how Parliament was saved. It's not a day of bloodthirstiness. It's a day of giving gifts and love. See, God's enemies were characterized by hatred, wanting to kill people even though they knew the law was against them. But God's people celebrate by love. There's no excuse here for holy war or Christians committing acts of genocide to kill people. Rather, they're characterized by love. And Christians also know that the day of judgment is coming, and those that have hurt and destroyed God's people will be judged. You see, remember the scare? The small scare brings about a small relief, but a great scare brings about a great relief. If you're a Christian here this morning, you can look back and see what you were destined for and how much you loved, and there's joy. As you stared at the mouth of hell, terror, destruction, that meets those that oppose the God of the universe, you can now marvel at the good news and see, but for the grace of God, go, ah, thank you for Jesus. Thank you for that rescue. And there's a day coming when the enemies of God and all the things that the devil had wrought about, bringing about in destruction as death, mourning, brokenness, and pain, will be wiped out. And at Revelation reading 19, Jesus is terrifying. He's a warrior, a conqueror. But in the next chapter, it describes the Lord Jesus Christ taking his people in his arms and wiping away their tears and saying there will be no longer any pain or suffering. And so who is Jesus for you? See, he's our champion as Christians. And he's coming about to bring about judgment. No longer will he be mocked. He comes in glory as he is. And I urge you, if it's a day of terror for you, turn to him now. For those who are Christians, no matter what you're going through at this moment, whatever suffering, hardship, sickness, or pain that affects you and your family, you can cling to the fact that your champion is coming. And he'll wipe away your tears, and he'll deal out justice to those that oppose him. Victory is coming, and so we are being welcomed home. And so we can celebrate with exceeding joy. We know how it ends, even amidst a world of destruction, pain, sin, and suffering. Amen.